today's law students are tomorrow's lawyers and, you know, the day after tomorrow's judges. I used to make this horrible joke. I would say we will innovate one funeral at a time, meaning we're waiting for the old guard to die out so that the new guard can come in and understands the value of these changes.
Today on Law Next, for 28 years, John Mayer has been executive director of the Center for Computer-Assisted Legal Instruction, or CALI, a nonprofit consortium of some 200 law schools that describes itself as, quote, the innovative force pushing legal education toward change for the better. Along the way, CALI's mission expanded to addressing access to justice, primarily through its development in partnership with the Chicago College of Law, of A to J Author, an expert system designed to help self-represented litigants complete court forms and navigate legal processes. This is Bob Ambrogi, and you are listening to Law Next, the podcast that features the innovators and entrepreneurs who are driving what's next in law. I'll get to my interview with John in just a moment, but first, let's hear about the sponsors who make this podcast possible. Immigration law can be complex, but managing your practice doesn't have to be. Lolly Law is the number one case management software tailor-made to help immigration lawyers automate their practices. Now with the new Lolly Payments, your firm can offer a compliant and secure way for clients to pay online. With custom payment plans, monthly reporting, payments via SMS, and the ability to track in-person payments, your firm can provide flexible payment options no matter your client's needs. Learn why Lolly Law is the trusted solution for immigration law firms at lollylaw.com. Now let's get to that conversation with John Mayer. John, welcome to Law Next.
Hey, thanks, Bob. Glad to be here.
It's good to see you. It's been a while since I've seen you in the flesh, I guess, but sounds like maybe we're going to do that next week as we're recording this, because we're both going to be at the American Association of Law Libraries convention in Denver. I'm really looking forward to that. How have you been over these like two or going on 3 years of craziness? How have things been going for you generally?
I think going very well. CALI is about computer assisted instruction, so we were already an online, remote, asynchronous sort of company with staff in four different cities. So the transition, at least as far as that aspect of it goes, wasn't tremendously difficult.
Well, that's good to hear. So I had a listener recently contact me and say, you know, one of the problems with your podcast is you often just launch into asking people about their backgrounds and their history, and you never tell me what they do in the first place. So I'm going to start by asking you, what does CALI do? Give me the short version, and we'll obviously talk a lot more about it. But what's the elevator pitch here?
Sure. So CALI is a nonprofit for 501c3. A consortium of mostly U.S. law schools. So almost every law school is a member. They pay $8,000 per year, and that gives us a budget of about $1.6 million. And with that, we produce interactive online web-based tutorials in the law. In other words, tutorials that teach the law. And they're written by law faculty, and there's over 1,200 of them in 40 different subject areas. That's our primary. That's computer-assisted legal instruction, CALI. We also publish casebooks. We give law faculty money. They write a casebook, and then we give it away for free as an ebook. And there's more to it than that, but I'll move on. And we also develop software. We've written software for writing lessons and for adding interactions to casebooks, and as well as software that helps legal aid attorneys and court staff automate court forms. So it's called A to J Author. It's a no-code web-based application. And the reason why CALI, computer-assisted legal instruction, does it is because it's also used in law schools as a training tool. So that's our three big projects. But if you ask any law student about CALI, it's highly likely that they'll say, oh yeah, the CALI Awards.
Which are, what are the CALI Awards?
So we manage the awards. The students who get the highest grade in the class, as determined by the faculty, can be given an award by the school through us. And we've been doing that for 27 years. We kind of picked up the ball when the old and you're an old man like me. You remember the Amateur or the Book Award, you know, that died about in the mid-90s, and we saw an opportunity and picked it up.
Yeah. So you have been executive director of Cali since 1994, but I know that Cali's roots reach back into the early 1970s, which seems to have been remarkably prescient, given how long ago that feels like right now. Knowing that you weren't there in the early 1970s, but what do you know about how Cali came about? What was its reason for getting formed in the first place?
Well, I had a woman who worked for Cali for over 40 years, Lavon Molda. She's retired now 4 or 5 years. And I got her to tell me the story because she was actually there in the late 70s when Zeus's lightning bolt came down. And the story right.
Some listeners will be surprised that there were computers at that point. But
well, there was this group, and I don't even know the name, but they came to the University of Minnesota, and they demonstrated how you could do interactive, you know, ask a question, student types the answer, get feedback, and then branch or not based on the response. And they demonstrated it to the deans or the heads of all the colleges at the University of Minnesota. This is the late 70s. This is and it's not Plato, but it sounds an awful lot like Plato, which was a big thing that came out of the University of Illinois. So the only school to pick up on this and say, we should do something with this, was the law school. And that was Roger Park and Russ Burris. And they were hooking up with the folks at Harvard, Don Troutman and many others, you know, whose names, dim in my memory, because they saw that, wow, asking a question, giving feedback, changing the answer or changing the parameters of the question, giving different feedback. Well, that's Socratic dialogue. And that's what we do in the law school classroom. And so they saw computer assisted instruction as a natural fit to legal education. In the late 70s. So prescient? Absolutely. But to them, it was a perfect fit.
Yeah. So what did they do about that? And how did that recognition evolve into the creation of what is today Cali?
Well, they hired, you know, they got some money. I don't even know where the very early money came from, unless it was from, you know, like a dean's project or something, and hired programmers. And the very first Cali lessons ran on teletypes. I kid you not. They were paper scrolled teletypes that you would print the text, and then you would type the answer. It would go back to a mainframe, come back and provide the feedback. So they weren't even personal computer or CRT screen based, you know, until the teletypes got replaced by green screens. 3270 yeah. terminals or something like that. Right. And the very first lessons were a natural for this. They were hearsay. You know, they would present you with some scenario and say, you know, hearsay, inadmissible hearsay, you know, or they would play a cross examination or a direct examination, and you would have to respond saying, you know, yeah, I would object to that because it's this type of hearsay. And every question was just, you know, is it hearsay? Yes, no. What type of hearsay? Multiple choice question. You know, what about this? Multiple choice question. So it worked inside that model very well. Yeah. When the PCs, of course, came along in the 70s, the Apple and the Amiga, and the 80s, the IBM PC, the whole thing got recoded in UCSD Pascal, University of Cal, San Diego. And the reason for using that was it was cross-platform. You could get a UCSD Pascal compiler that would compile to Apple or to Amiga. I'm not sure it was Amiga even, IBM PC. And that was a big deal because nobody, you know, different computer, different labs and different people own different operating systems. So they wanted to be able to work on whatever type of device that people had.
And putting them on floppy disks at that point, or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was floppy disks. You know, it turned into Turbo Pascal. It turned into other things later. By the time I showed up at Cali, we were still sending around a binder full of 5 1/4 inch floppies that had to be installed, you know, 100 diskettes that had to be installed individually on lab computers in law schools. It was the rise of computer labs. It was only later that that became a single install on a network drive, and then it became a CD that you could either install from or put into a CD tower, and then later a DVD-ROM. And, you know, by the time I show up in 94, I'm like, you know, there's this internet thing. We should start doing that because the logistics of mailing those things around was complicated.
Yeah. So how did you show up? How did you get connected with this organization? What were you doing before that?
Well, I was I joined the Chicago Kent College of Law in 1987 as their computer lab manager. Funny story there. I was deciding to move from my old job. I was working at a hospital, and I went to my mom's house because she's the one that kept the Sunday paper. But she had made cookies that week, and so she used the job section to put the cookies on and put the paper out on the porch, and the squirrels had chewed up the paper thinking there was, like, you know, this cookie smell coming from it. And so I only, like, had pieces of the job section to look through. And I kid you not, and I've actually got it in a folder. One of the jobs was the computer lab manager at Chicago Kent, and the bottom half, you know, right up to where the phone number was chewed away. But I was able to make the phone call and eventually get the job. So I always say, if the squirrels were a little hungrier, Bob, you and I wouldn't be talking right now.
And who knows what great opportunities you missed out on because of the squirrels. But this one worked out pretty well for you, I think.
It did. I loved working. I mean, I took the job at Chicago Kent because they were affiliated with IIT, and they gave me free tuition to get my master's degree in computer science. So I was kind of there opportunistically. But working with Ron Stout there, and he had all sorts of interesting ideas. And along about in the 90s, early 90s, he created a branch. He got some grant money and created a branch of Cali at Chicago Kent to join Minnesota and Harvard. And so I got to work on a lot of Cali-related projects as part of my day job. And when the executive director position opened in 94, you know, I had been 7 years at the law school. We had built a brand new building, and I was kind of like looking for a new adventure. And the Cali job looked like a new adventure.
Yeah. And you mentioned Ron Stout, and there may well be some people listening to this who don't know who Ron Stout was, but he was really one of the true trailblazers in the area of bringing technology into the law school environment on one hand, and also in considering applications of technology in enhancing access to justice in the practice of law more broadly. You know, what can you tell people about Ron and what you know about him?
Well, to coin a phrase, everything old is new again. In 1985, he worked on a document automation project that ran on essentially DOS batch files called Project Pericles. And even Mark Lauridsen, who today still works with Capstone and Hot Docs, was a youngster working on that project. We put a PC on a desk at the Daly Center in Chicago with some document filler outer software, all based on WordPerfect. And a laser printer. And, you know, I was the tech support for dozens of students who helped people who were wandering around trying to figure out, you know, what to do with themselves at the Daly Center. We worked with Jim's with the American Bar Foundation on a search engine, you know, that would be sort of like a DOS-based, PC-based search engine. This was even before Lexis and Westlaw were right. Widely available.
Yeah.
Long about 1989, they started to allow schools to dial up using modems, you know, and then later we got a gateway card, you know, an X.25, and then later, of course, they went to the internet. But in those times, doing like little search engines could mean you could do little bits of discovery or little bits of legal research, you know, on your own PC, and that was an amazing thing.
Yeah. And do you still have any relationship to Chicago Kent College of Law?
Sure. And this is an artifact of how Cali is set up. I'm technically an employee of Chicago Kent College of Law and have been since 87, so 35 years or something like that. 35 years this year. So I think I'll get a gold pen this year. And the reason is when Cali set up, there were no employees of Cali. Everybody was an employee of the host institution. And then when Cali turned into a nonprofit in 1982 and started collecting dues, they just gave money to the host institution and said, here, pay our employees for us. That turned into a more formalized arrangement. And so, you know, I've still got an employee at University of Minnesota. I've got five or six at Chicago Kent, and I've got one at Emory. And then I've got a couple of people that don't work for any of those institutions. We pay them through, you know, using our own ADP or something like that. And the value of that is we were for all these years embedded inside law schools. And so we could walk down halls and talk to faculty or go to the cafeteria and set up a table and do user testing with students. You know, we weren't apart from the constituency that we were dealing with. And that's been very beneficial, I think, over the years.
All right. So I want to ask you a question. I was looking around your website, and on the front of your website, it says, Cali is the innovative force pushing legal education toward change for the better. So how has legal education done in on that front? I mean, as I say, you've been at this almost 30 years, and I think there is still very much a perception that law schools have not done a very good job of incorporating technology into their environments. I think kind of two sides to the coin. One is in using technology to enhance instruction, and the other side of that is in teaching students about how to use technology and tech competence. But what's your perception? I mean, what kinds of progress have you seen over the years in how effectively law schools are using tech on that side of enhancing how they instruct students and how tech can play a role in that?
Well, in some ways, we've come a long way. There was tremendous resistance to the idea that you could that the student would bring a computer into the classroom and take their notes on the computer, right. and even to the point where there was a large number of faculty who would make a rule saying you can't have an open laptop in my class because right. chances are you're going to be surfing Facebook or you know checking your mail or something like that. Or shopping.
Right, which is probably right.
And to a large degree, now that we all have computers, multiple computers, you know, cell phones and computers, that's kind of faded away. The second big thing is in the ebooks. We're seeing a lot of progress right now in open casebooks because people are realizing, you know, why do these things cost $300? And oh, by the way, with an open book, I get to move the chapters around or add my own commentary, and the students get to either read it on a screen if they want, or read it, buy a paper book at cost. I was just watching a Twitter thread a couple of days ago of faculty arguing with each other about open books, and I was like, usually I have to be the one to start these arguments, and here it is out in the wild happening without me. I was overjoyed. So some progress, definitely, but in some ways we didn't have to push very hard because, of course, technology moved into everybody's lives without us saying, you know, all students should have a computer. It's like that's not even an issue. Everybody buys a computer before they go to school.
Right.
Now, and the tooling out there is so vast and rich that everybody decides for themselves how to build their own educational or their own learning environment. So we're part of that. And the expectation isn't that everybody should use Cali lessons all the time. It's more like if these will help you, then you should definitely check them out. And we'll do everything we can to make them as high quality and as purposefully useful as we can.
Yeah. I happened to be at a law school on March 12th, 2020, on the day that kind of all hell broke loose in the world. Mm-hmm. And the day that the law school decided it was going to have to shut down, send students home and try and convert to virtual instruction. And I remember this concern that I was hearing there on the campus of the law school not for whether the students would be able to adapt, but to whether the faculty and administrators would be able to adapt to this. And, you know, that's just 2.5 years ago, which again, raises some questions in my mind about how technologically literate faculty are, even in this time, as you say, when we all have computers and we all understand the technology. I wonder to what extent faculty have begun to really make this a part of their instructional methods.
Well, one word, Zoom. I mean, we've been doing GoToMeeting stuff for 10 years. And at the beginning of the pandemic, I thought, oh, everybody's going to jump on GoToMeeting. Maybe I should buy some GoToMeeting stock right now. I was vaguely aware of Zoom, but I didn't know that it would that anybody else was aware of how easy it was. And faculty loved it because they could go from standing in front of their class talking to standing in front of their computer talking. No change. Except, but they were in another environment that had some affordances for like breakout rooms. They could send links. They could use chat and Q&A. And so at least their minds were expanded a little bit as to, you know, this distance learning thing isn't as horrible as it could be. Now, when you start doing it 5 hours a day, 5 days a week, it started to feel a little horrible because we were trapped in our little square boxes. But it opened the minds for a lot of faculty to be at least willing to explore the idea of remote learning. We saw a 10-20% increase in use of Kali lessons. We saw a doubling in the use of a tool that we call Lesson Link, where you assign a Kali lesson and the faculty get to see the scores. In June of that year, June of 2020, we did a mini course on distance learning for law faculty and had 900 of them sign up for it. Now, the subtag of that was, take a class like your students are going to be taking from you. And as a result, they hated it, or some of them hated it, right? Because they had to sit there for an hour and watch people lecture. I mean, we brought in experts on instructional design and stuff like that, but they're like, oh my God, I really should take a break every 15 minutes because this is agony to sit here and listen for an hour. Yeah. And so they got, we had about 50% of them had a very positive experience, and we introduced them to a lot of possibilities and technologies, including Kali stuff. And about 50% of them were like, this is going to be awful. but everybody got their mind blown, I think, a little bit.
Yeah. So it sounds like you're saying that the pandemic clearly had an impact on getting faculty to use technology more than they had before, or at least use Zoom more than they had before. But that the impact wasn't necessarily dramatic, that this was already happening and that law schools were well on their way towards incorporating technology in instruction. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, this super tanker is just too big to turn fast. And it's even true of higher ed, right? But it's harder to talk about higher ed because it's a massive market, from the top 100 schools of the elite and the wealthy, and then the vast middle of state schools and the middle class, and then the gigantic tail, which is community colleges and the majority of people going to college. Law schools is a little bit more of a scrunched in market. You know, if you're going to law school, even the bottom ranked of the ABA accredited schools, you know, you've accomplished something to get there and to graduate if you can. So,
yeah. So I mean, that's one side of the coin, is getting law schools using technology as an instructional method or as part of their overall instructional approach. The other side of that coin is actually getting law students to understand technology and become competent in using technology in law practice. And I don't know if that's something that you are involved in at all through Kali, but what have you seen law schools doing, or what kind of progress have you seen law schools making in teaching law students about how to competently use technology?
Well, right now it's a rich it's a target rich environment of people doing different things. I've been running a blog where I collect syllabi from faculty who teach any sort of technology-related law school course. There's like 70 or 80 syllabi we've collected. And what you get from looking at all the syllabi, because I look at all of them as they come in, is that it's all over the place, right? So we're not in sort of like a settled, everybody can agree what the lawyers need to understand. I mean, there are some things that we all wish everybody was smarter at, but there's too much change going on for everything to settle down into a standardized. And when you can't settle into a standardized model, you can't scale any sort of solution. So nobody's going to write the perfect tech competency product or tech competency curriculum because there's too much variation in what tech competency might mean for different types of lawyers. Tech competency for a legal aid attorney, for a government attorney, for a litigation attorney, for a tax attorney are all different things, I believe.
Yeah, I had a guest on this podcast, I don't know if you remember, April Dawson from North Carolina Central University School of Law, and she has just been named Associate Dean of Tech and Innovation there, but she had been an Associate Dean for a number of years and focused a lot on teaching tech in law schools. And one of the points that she made that I thought was really interesting was her feeling was it's not so much about teaching specific technologies, like, you know, how to do e-discovery per se using technology or something, but more about creating an environment within a law school in which technology is just par for the course. It's this is how lawyers work. You know, technology is part of how lawyers work, and therefore it's part of how we teach and think about and operate in a law school environment. I always thought that was a really interesting idea to just think about it as it's not something special that needs to be taught. It's just normal. It's just par for the course. This is how we work in law now.
Right. Every law firm should have a case management or a matter management system. The surveys I continue to see show that there's still 50% of them running things off Excel and Word.
Right.
And everybody should accept credit cards through the web. And everybody should do Zoom calls with clients. And every court should start thinking about, you know, is this something that we have to haul everybody in from the distance survey, you know, and take a day off, you know, purchase parking and come into this room? Or can we just do this as can this meeting be an email? I guess the equivalent for a lot of matters before courts could be, can this hearing be a Zoom call? And that's got to save people. I mean, it's so obvious that it saves people time, money, effort, that there should be a nice dividend of ubiquitous technology availability that's going to make everybody's lives a little bit easier. Now, let's not waste that dividend and say, great, I can charge more, or great, I'm making more money, because we have a broken justice system with so many people going unrepresented and so much of the administrative state becoming too difficult for your average unrepresented person to deal with. And the lawyers, of course, responding with, well, if there's no lawyer there, then it can't be done. It's got to be a lawyer. You know, none of these navigators or LLT things or paralegal pluses, you know, that's gonna bite into our monopoly. And as we've seen in the medical world, right, there's urgent care, there's emergency rooms, there's hospitals and clinics of all kinds. And you only see the doctor when it raises to the level of needing to. You know, the nurse can give you, you know, instruction, change your bandages, and so on. Why not the same for law?
The core of Cali's mission is using computers and technology to enhance and improve legal education. But Cali is also involved in efforts to enhance access to justice, most notably through A2J Author, the expert system it co-developed in 2005 to help unrepresented litigants navigate the legal system. When we return, we'll learn more about how and why A2J Author was developed and how it is used in courts and by legal services organizations. But first, this word from the generous sponsors who make this podcast possible. Immigration lawyers need the flexibility to meet their clients where they are. With Lolly Law, you can provide customized solutions for every unique case you take on. With built-in features like the new Lolly Payments, your firm can easily create automated payment plans, allow clients to send payments via SMS, and accept payments online or in person. so you can provide a hassle-free payment experience that gets you paid faster. To learn more about how LollyLaw can support your practice, visit LollyLaw.com. Welcome back to Law Next. My guest John Mayer has been executive director of Cali for nearly three decades, which means he's had a front row seat to the evolution of technology in legal education, legal practice, and the courts. In the second half of the show, we'll talk about his thoughts on the future of innovation in law and on the future of Cali. But first, we talk about Cali's role in developing and popularizing the expert system A to J author. Let's get back to that conversation. We've talked about several of the products, if you want to call them that, that you've developed related to legal instruction. But another important piece of software that you've developed is A to J Author, which is essentially an expert system using guided interviews that helps pro se litigants complete court forms or get through legal processes. How did Cali get from a focus on legal education into also branching off into creating this product that addresses access to justice?
It's a good story, and it started in 2000. I had been with Cali for about 7 years, and I had a very academic board of directors who said, 7 years, it's sabbatical time. And they said, John, why don't you take a sabbatical? You know, turn the dials back on your executive director stuff and go think about some deep thoughts, write a paper or a book or do a project, you know. And right about that time, this is interesting for Ron Stout was working with the Chicago Bar Foundation, the State Justice Institute, and the National Center for State Courts to do a study where Chicago Kent law students would work with IIT Research Institute students, in other words, design students, and they would go visit courts and watch pro ses, self-represented litigants, bumble and stumble their way through trying to solve their own legal problems. So they did that project. I went along. I visited four or five courts and spent entire days watching people do this. They wrote a book called Meeting the Needs, Access to Justice. It's a kind of a hard-to-read book because it's written in a design-y language. But out of it were 200 ideas on how to improve the justice system. The Legal Services Corporation was just at that moment launching the TIG program, the Technology Initiative Grants. Mm-hmm. So we applied for some money and said, you know, we've got this idea to write a piece of software that would have legal aid attorneys automating court forms, a la TurboTax, which is everybody uses that as an example. But here was the reason why I was able to sell it to my board and to Cali. It turns out that the problem of teaching a law faculty how to code a lesson that walks a student through complicated law was very similar to teaching a legal aid attorney on how to code an interview that walks a pro se through filling out a form. So intellectually, they were the same sort of steps. There was a question answer branch or not based on it, you know, underlying model. And so the same programmer who did all the Cali author, all the Cali lessons, wrote the first iteration of A to J author, essentially using the same model. You know, we just put a different interface on it. Now, it was 2005 when we were doing this. He wrote it in Flash because at the time was the browser wars. Netscape versus IE were all over the place. And so if you did anything in a browser, you ran into that works in Netscape, it doesn't work in IE, vice versa. Mm-hmm. And we're like, what a headache. Flash solved it for us because it was its own plugin that was the same no matter which browser you were in. So it made total sense to do it at the time. And it lasted for over 10 years. I mean, you know, it took until Steve Jobs came along and put a bullet in the brain of Flash before we had to change that. But that's why we did it. It was technically similar to what we were already doing. We knew that the tool once written would be useful and could be used by schools to teach students how to automate forms, because in order to automate a form, you have to understand the underlying law. You know, you have to do a lot of research. And, you know, we also thought it would be a natural to drop in the clinic courses, because the clinic people, you'd think, we're doing lots of pro se or indigent client interfacing.
Yeah.
But for reasons that I can explain later, the clinics didn't turn out to be the best way to do this.
Well, go ahead and explain why. Why not?
Oh. Well, in all design, you always have to serve the customer or the client. And the client in this case, yeah. The clinic instructor, the clinic is trying to take as much time as possible and put the student in front of a client and teach them that human right. empathy, that interaction. And so the idea that we would come away and take time away from that so that the student sat in front of a computer we weren't going to sell that. And so we moved off trying to convince clinics to do this and just went to the regular faculty and said, you know, you could make this part of an elder law course or part of a civil procedure course or part of an IP course, you know, because all of those have some kind of form or some kind of interactive guided interview that could result in a guidance or advice to a client.
That study that you alluded to, that the Access to Justice, the book that I guess you called it that came out, which I think I found. I think it's still online.
It is.
Access to Justice, Meeting the Needs of Self-Represented Litigants. It's a 477 page, and I can't say I read it all, but I did start to skim through it. And I mean, it seems like the focus of that, and maybe the original focus of A to J Author, was really on the interface between unrepresented litigants and the courts, kind of directly, without necessarily legal services involved or anybody else. It was the idea really to kind of streamline, or not streamline, but to smooth the ability of unrepresented litigants to interface with the courts, or was there a broader mission around it?
Well, even early on and even to this day, working with the courts is difficult. If you thought law professors were hidebound and resistant to change, then welcome to the courts. Not all of them. I mean, there's exceptions to that. And so I mean, this was a great idea whether the courts were on board or not. And it was even a great idea whether or not legal aid was on, but we had to get somebody. So we worked with legal aid. With the TIG program, LSC would give money to legal aides that would give legal aid attorneys time off to automate forms.
Yep.
So they knew that only 50% or less or more of the people who needed their help couldn't get it because there weren't enough legal aid attorneys. So if they would automate the simple stuff like expungement, domestic violence, temporary restraining orders, uncontested divorces, not divorces with children. And we even did a survey of, you know, there's at least 100 forms in every state of what I call the low-hanging fruit, that if we just automated all of those, you know, it wouldn't take any money away from lawyers because nobody can make any money on these low-hanging fruit simple stuff, but it would greatly improve the situation of SRLs, of self-represented litigants. And my estimation is that we're only about 20% done with that project. You know, in the 15, almost 20 years that we've been doing A to J Author. And so there's still a lot of what I would call benefit left on the table for us to harvest. And we should do that. Now, you could do complicated things with A to J Author. I've seen guided interviews with 400 or 500 questions that do very complex branching and stuff like that. But the problem with that is they take so long to build. They're expensive in terms of people's time. And I'm like, well, let's do the easy stuff first, you know, because it's a smaller, shorter project. You can get students involved, but there's always a problem. Students are the worst people to automate forms alone because they have no experience, right? They're students. Yeah. But if you put a student at the elbow of a subject matter expert, an experienced attorney, you know, then the student is the more tech-savvy side of that equation. Yeah. And they'll translate the subject matter expertise into the A to J no code or whatever tool they're using, be it DocAssemble, HotDocs, Neota, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, that then becomes a, you know, scalable 24/7 to self-represented litigants anytime they want.
Yeah.
I mean, we've more than adequately proved that this is a money saver, but the problem is it's a principal agent problem, right? It saves the self-represented litigants money, but it doesn't save the government money because this is just unrealized demand. It doesn't save the courts money because they don't see it that way. And so we struggle to convince people that this should be done and that it will benefit society.
Yeah. It's interesting that you talk about the difficulty of working with the courts. I found that, found the report, and I skipped right to the conclusion of the report, in which one of the things they said in the conclusion, this is back in what, 2002, I think it was, or something like that.
Yeah,
that,
20
that
years
report
ago.
Report came out. And they say that, you know, for our system of solutions to adapt, for what they've talked about in this report, it would have to provide a way for the court, in particular its administrators, to gain feedback on how well the system is working. Feedback could come from the system's users, including self-represented litigants, attorneys, clerks, and judges. It's critical that the system provide administrators with direction so that they may change the system as societal change dictates. Which sort of presumes that courts are sort of interested in customer service, if you want to call it that, and they aren't. They aren't, right?
Oh, that was so radical to say to courts, you know, you're kind of a business, and you should get feedback from your customers. And they're like, what are you talking about? Yeah. And this was 20 years, right? Everything
old
is new again.
That's changed. I mean, again, the pandemic question, but the courts, some say the pandemic has caused the courts to be at least more conscious about, well, both the combination of the pandemic and the ever widening access to justice crisis has caused the courts to kind of wake up a little bit and say, we really need to be changing something here.
So have things changed? Absolutely. There's a crack. You know, we have cracked the monolith, at least we've cracked it. And so everybody with half a brain can look at what courts do when they throw up an image PDF and say, this is good enough, when they provide, you know, crappy or horrible directions, or when they yell at you when you get things wrong, and say, that's not how modern businesses run. You know, look, if my bakery can let me place orders online, why can't a court have a calendar that, you know, emails me and reminds me or texts me when there's a change, you know? And this whole bit about PACER costing money, I mean, everybody knows this is so obviously, you know, antediluvian and old school. So we're all in agreement. I guess we just have to finish working through the obvious thing that will happen, which is PACER will be free. Courts will get a baseline case management system. You know, the low-hanging fruit forms will all get automated. E-filing will be ubiquitous. We'd rather it'll flip all at once, right? It'll go from hardly any e-filing to everybody just agreeing that this is how we're going to do e-filing, and then it's going to be the required way of doing it.
It's been interesting to me just because go ahead.
I was going to say, sort of like the way, you know, I mean, you're old enough to remember before credit cards were ubiquitous, and then they became ubiquitous. When traveling in a foreign country meant exchanging money or getting American Express traveler's checks or something, and then it was just a credit card, and how the ATMization of the world simplified everything. And now we don't even think about it. We're waiting for that to happen to courts. And it's so close.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what it feels like. It's close only because we are some of the momentum for change that we are now seeing is actually coming from the courts. And again, you know, we talked any number of times about Arizona and Utah and what's going on in those states in terms of re-regulation. But so much of the momentum for that change in those states has come from the courts. And that's encouraging to me, I think.
It's encouraging and discouraging at the same time. I gave a presentation. This was a couple of, right before the pandemic, to a state's worth of clerks of the courts meeting, and we told them the happy story of A to J Author. We showed them how we automated 40 forms with the New York Family Courts. We told them stories about how clerks now were happy they could drink their coffee. People would come up and praise them for this automated system that was so much easier than filling out the paper forms. And then we waited. You know, we sat back and waited for the tsunami of people wanting to work with us. And instead, they were like, yeah, we're not going to do that. And we're like, but it's free. I mean, our software is open source, and they if they want to host it themselves, or will host it. And they were like, I don't trust you. You know, it must be, if it's free, it must be worth nothing, you know. So you run into that problem of doing all the work of designing something that actually works, testing it, proving it, and still running into the wall of resistance to change.
Well, mentioning a prior presentation you gave me a great segue to another question I wanted to ask you, because I came across a presentation you gave, I think this was back in 2016, but in which your opening slide said, "Wired justice starts with wired legal education." I love that quote, but I wasn't sure I fully knew what it meant. But I wonder, does that suggest to you that the kind of change we're talking about in the courts, in access to justice, begins with legal education?
Well, it doesn't begin, but it certainly would help if we would train, if we could demonstrate to our students that things could be different. At the same time, being realistic with them and saying, you know, the courts are still run by a thought process from the past. But today's law students are tomorrow's lawyers and, you know, the day after tomorrow's judges, you know, and they will have, you know, I used to make this horrible joke, which I'm embarrassed to tell it to you. But I used to do this in presentations. I would say we will innovate one funeral at a time, you know, meaning, you know, in the Thomas Kuhn sense, we're waiting for the old guard to die out so that the new guard can come in and understands the value of these changes.
Yeah, although to that I often respond, look, I'm part of the old guard, and yet I get it.
Right. Who's waiting for me to die?
But yeah, I mean, it is a matter of perspective often rather than age. I mean, I went to law school really before, I think Lexis went on, the electronic version of Lexis probably came about while I was at law school. You know, we started with books and ended with terminals. And the IBM PC came out when I was in law school, I think. I've seen the arc of how far we've come and yet how far we haven't come over all of that time. What about for Callie? I mean, as I said, you've been there nearly 30 years and yeah, you know, you are getting up there, not as old as I am, but, at some point you're probably going to be thinking about transitioning. What's the future look like for Callie? What does the focus look like? How does it evolve as an organization?
Well, that's a question that I ponder daily. One of the things that Callie represents is a business model that's unlike almost everybody else, which is to say, rather than pay for things by selling them and then having a profit that can be paid back to owners or shareholders, we have a consortium business model that says every law school will put a little bit of money into a pool, and the pool will be used to hire programmers or to work on projects that benefit everybody who put a little bit of money into the pool, or will benefit everybody, you know. So we're like the, you know, FSF or like the EFF, you know, the Free Software Foundation or like the Apache Foundation.
Yeah.
But where we're not just doing software, we're also doing content. We're also doing data, games, anything that looks like it would be one. It will improve legal education, and not necessarily for everybody, but for more than just like an individual. You know, I don't like working on people's pet projects. I like working on projects that I know will scale, and even better, every project I like to put the word author on the end of them. You know, a project where I could. You know, we can build it, but here's the tool. You can build it too, because I most of all want to return agency, or tell law schools and law faculty, you are responsible for the education. Don't outsource the construction of the casebooks, the construction of the curriculums, the constructions of the courses. That's a core competency for what you are, a law school. I've not being a lawyer and not being a law faculty, I can say this. I think they spend too much time emphasizing the legal scholarship, which is valuable, but only to a point. And I would like to see more law schools and law faculty spend more time on legal education. And for that matter, is legal education as scholarship, the thing that benefits both the teaching of law and the dissemination of information about the justice system.
And it sounds like what you're saying then is a big part of what you're trying to do is provide, I don't know, enablement, empowerment for them to do that through technology?
Yeah, we're not, the tooling out there is like, I think I started at the beginning of this interview, the tooling out there is so rich that very small teams can build very powerful things. I mean, I've only got 11 staff total, and we you know, using our tools, you can build an entire curriculum of interactive tutorials. You could write a book and publish it with us. You could create formative assessments, you know, and deliver them to your students. You know, you could literally run a law school out of Cali's content today, except for the faculty. You know, you have to hire faculty and you have to, you know, do the administrative work of that sort of thing. But I'm talking about the essential content stuff. Now, you shouldn't do it that way. You should start, you know, we provide a, we've raised all boats. The minimum should be what is available for free from Cali. Well, for free if you pay your membership. And from there, I believe we want people to stand on our shoulders and do more and do better. And I believe that model can be applied to a lot of other things inside of legal education, such that schools can lower the cost of delivering education and can make gradual iterative improvements on the quality of the content that they deliver.
Yeah. And what about on that A to J side? I mean, does A to J author, I know that that's something that you've continued to iterate over the years. Do you see yourself branching out in other ways into addressing the A to J issue?
Absolutely. Right now, we're partnering heavily with Pro BonoNet and LawHelp Interactive. So the majority of A to J guided interviews run from their platform. We have our own platform at a2j.org for those people that are not part of the legal aid world or just want to do their own thing. And we support people who download the software from GitHub and want to do their own self-hosting for whatever reason. A lot of times it's legal operations outside the U.S. that don't want to be housed on American servers for mm-hmm. policy reasons or something like that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Can we build more? Heck yeah. I don't think we're done solving the ease of use problems with walking people through their problems. I mean, it's a target-rich environment. I mean, there's right. so much more that could be done in helping people deal with the legal system. I agree. It would be great if somebody would redesign the legal system so it was more coherent and intelligible to the average citizen. But I'm not holding my breath for that.
That ain't happening in our lifetime, though.
Yeah. So I've got to design systems and processes and business models to what exists today, and that's fine. That's a challenge, yeah. And I'm fascinated to take it on.
Yeah. John, we are about at the end of our time, but I always like to just ask if there's anything else you wanted to say or mention about Cali or about yourself or anything else before we wrap up.
Oh, wow. I even knew this question was coming, and I thought I had something prepared. It's just to say that, you know, a few people with a little money can still be very powerful. And the difficulty we have is that the world is so noisy, and we're involved in, I learned a new word a couple weeks ago, we're involved in a poly crisis. Right, not just one crisis, but many crises: school shootings, COVID, the Supreme Court going crazy, things like that. It's a poly crisis. That it's hard to pay attention to small projects that are doing what I believe to be seminal work. And so take a moment to pay attention to us, because I think we're doing things that are, you know, Archimedes' lever. We're gonna move the world if we can, you know, engage enough people in our projects.
Yeah, there are lots of people chipping away, and all of that chipping makes a difference. So I agree. Well, thanks so much for talking. It's been great to see you, and I look forward to seeing you in the flesh next week in Denver at AALL.
It's been a delight. Thanks, Bob.
A big thanks to John Mayer, Executive Director of the Center for Computer-Assisted Legal Instruction, for joining me today. I appreciate his insights as well as his time. What are your thoughts on today's show? Share them by tweeting us at LawNext Podcast. LawNext is produced, engineered, and edited by Populous Radio. I'm your host, Bob Ambrogi. I hope you'll join us again next time for another episode of LawNext.